Good morning and welcome to the Friday, June 12th, 2009 edition of the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski, and you're listening to LibertyRadioLive.com. All week long, I've been talking about the Tony Alamo ministry case in one way or another, presenting people from the ministry, others who have talked about what's going on regarding this case. And today I have on the attorney who's representing Alamo Ministries and the children that have been taken into state custody. His name is Philip Kuhn from Florida. Now, Philip has filed a motion for a preliminary injunction in the federal courts to bypass the state courts in order to present his case that these children need to be released. In his brief, he's presented five major reasons why. I'll delineate a couple of those before I introduce Philip. One, he says is it permissible for the defendants to require church parents to leave the church housing and church employment as a condition of obtaining custody of their children? Is it permissible for the defendants to search for and take custody of children of church parents simply because the parents have some sort of association with the church? Is it permissible for the defendants to threaten and take into custody newborn babies of church parents at the moment of birth when they are not in danger? Is it permissible for the defendants to vaccinate children in foster care over the religious objections of the church parents? And finally, is it permissible for the defendants to institute policies that teach the children in foster care that their prior religious training was untruthful and that their parents mislead them in order to mainstream the children to the defendants' views of the world? Those are the main questions that Mr. Kuhn asks in this preliminary injunction. There's much more here. That's why I have Mr. Kuhn on. Mr. Kuhn, how are you today?
I'm good, Mr. Szymanski. How are you?
Good. And you're from Florida, correct?
I am.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself so our listeners understand who you are and how you got involved in this case and why you think it's so important.
Well, I've been practicing law for 44 years, primarily in the criminal and civil rights field. I practiced in Memphis, Tennessee for the first 19 years, and I've been in Florida now for 25 years. So I'm a member of both the Florida and Tennessee Bar Association. I started out my practice as a prosecutor in the state's attorney's office in Shelby County, Memphis. And I was assigned to Judge Battle's courtroom as a very young prosecutor just out of law school. And that's the judge that handles the James Earl Ray case for the assassination of Dr. King. So I worked on that case a little bit before I left the state attorney's office. And since then, I've just been in the private practice of law. Like I said, doing primarily federal criminal and civil rights work.
Okay. So now, why do you think this case is so important?
Well, I think the case presents a significant question of religious liberty. And I think it presents a significant question concerning the First Amendment rights of the citizens of the United States. And I just think that the way that the state of Arkansas went about this was incorrect, and it infringes upon the establishment of religion clause of the First Amendment, and also violates my client's rights to association, free speech, and the right of privacy.
All right. Now, tell us, you know, for our listeners who may not understand the court systems, why have you decided to go into federal court, and tell us the importance of this preliminary injunction? Go ahead.
Okay. There's a statute in the United States Code called 42 United States Code 1983, and that's basically the civil rights statute that allows you to sue state actors if they violate a constitutional right. And there's a provision in that statute that allows you to seek injunctions if the state actors are pursuing conduct that threatens First Amendment rights on a future basis. And the basis of federal jurisdiction is that statute. the 1983 suit, which is a civil rights suit, and it seeks to preserve the First Amendment rights and the Establishment of Religion clause in the First Amendment for the client.
Right. And in your case here, for example, you're asking for an injunction, which is asking the federal court to immediately release these children because your client's rights have been violated, rights that are protected by the Constitution and are God-given rights, and shouldn't be superseded by what the state is doing, which is basically turning this into some type of privilege, correct? And that's an important aspect of this case, I believe, because if the states can continue to legislate and then around the, so to speak, go around the corner and then use agencies like the Department of Human Services and Family Services to take away children and violate constitutional rights, this is the reason for going into federal court, correct, and preserving these God-given constitutional rights that we have as Americans, correct?
That's what we're trying. That's what we're trying to do, and that's the basis of the Injunction Act.
Okay, so generally that's what we're talking about here, folks. Now, let's go into the specifics of, I have the motion, the injunction in front of me here. Let's go into some of the specifics of what you're talking about. And I think it's interesting, I at the beginning of the show I talked about the five major points you bring up, but let's go into them. I see this basically as a witch hunt on this ministry. I've delineated on this show that since the 1980s, the government has tried to bring down this ministry. Now, in your addendum to this motion, you mentioned that the government at one point stated they didn't know anything about Tony Alamo and his ministry prior to the abuse charges, and you say this is false, correct?
I do, because the defendants made statements that they were just notified about this hours before the September 20th, 2008 raid on the compound.
Right.
But we've obtained other evidence, some of which is under seal, because there's a court order sealing some records, and there's a protective order issued by the federal court that's going to prevent me from talking about some of this. But anyway, we found evidence that indicate that this investigation of the church was instigated 2 years before the raid.
Mm-hmm.
And that some of the people were interviewed 6 months before the raid. So we're trying to get into the records of the Arkansas Department of Human Services, because I found in civil rights work that a lot of your evidence is in the records of the defendants to determine what they knew and when they knew it regarding the church. And so far, we had depositions set up with the defendants and 10, 11 other depositions set. And the Judge Barnes in the Western District just issued a stay order, staying discovery until he could decide the jurisdictional issue involved in the case. And I have a lot of respect for Judge Barnes. Judge Barnes is one of the finest jurists in the United States. So I think he'll eventually give us a hearing and give us some rights to discovery so we can take depositions of the state actors and that we can find, review some of their records. To see just what they knew and whether or not this was orchestrated.
Okay, now this case, now your defendants include all the children that are in custody, correct?
Well, we basically represent the church, and the church has, under the law, the church has individual standing because they're being harmed, and organizations enjoy First Amendment rights as well as citizens. And they have to also stand in a representative capacity of the congregation. So by representing the church, you might say I represent the children, but basically my client is the church.
Right. And in your conclusion here, and then we'll get back to some of the major points of the defendant's arguments and how you show that these arguments hold no legal ground, you say that there can be only one reason for the defendant's insistence that the plaintiffs sever their ties with the church, and that this is to attack the credibility of the church, even though the defendants admitted in their answer to the complaint that the church was not a cult. Now, this is a change because in the beginning, this was all over the newspapers that this was a cult. Now they've changed their tune. Explain how this is important.
They made some statements in their answer that they filed through the complaint that is contrary to what they have threatened to do. Like, they said in their answer that they did not intend to pick up newborns and that they were not looking for the other children of the church. But all the evidence we have and all the statements by their agents, which are the caseworkers, indicate something to the contrary. So I don't really know what their position is, because all I've received so far is their answer and brief and their motion in opposition to discovery, their brief on that. I hadn't had an opportunity to ask them questions under oath.
Now, since every day is important in the lives of these children and you've asked for an injunction, do you think the defendants are dragging their feet here?
Well, and my experience in civil rights work is that the defendants always draw the wagons into a circle and do whatever they can legally to delay the proceedings.
Okay. Now, let's talk about what are the arguments. I'm interested in this. What are the legal arguments? You know, I've had so much evidence. People come on this show talking about just what you talked about. People who've been with the ministry in the past, who've left the ministry, and then have been contacted by FBI agents, being harassed by them, trying to get them to change their to testify against Tony and the ministry. Some of them stating that they would never do that. Then speaking about, you know, other people coming on saying they've never seen abuse here. They've been with the ministry 40 years.
Right.
So we see all this kind of this evidence coming forward. Yet these children are still in custody. And what legal arguments are these people using to keep these people, to keep these children behind, away from their parents?
Well, let me be careful with this, because I'm, like I said, I'm under a protective order.
Okay.
And I wasn't involved in the original dependency actions. I didn't get involved in the case until the middle of March of this year. But I gather that they're saying that some of the practices of the church are exposing these children to some sort of danger at some point in the future.
Okay. And what your brief is trying to show is that legally they're under no danger here, correct?
Well,
that they're missing.
You know, the law in Arkansas says that a dependent, neglected juvenile means any juvenile who is at substantial risk of serious harm as a result of the following acts or omissions to the juvenile, a sibling, or another juvenile. And the key term in that is substantial. And the acts that they base their dependency, that you can base a dependency action on, is if you can show the child has been abandoned, abused, is subject to sexual abuse or sexual exploitation, neglect in some manner, parental unfitness, or being present in a dwelling or structure and doing the manufacturing of crack cocaine with knowledge of his or her parent, guardian, or custodian. And that is the legal standard which they have to prove. And I don't think there's any evidence the parents abandoned these children. how in the world you could ever find evidence that would show some sort of sexual abuse or sexual exploitation of one-year-old children or two-year-old children or children that are just born.
Yeah.
I don't know what the evidence of neglect is, if any, and I can guarantee you that none of these parents are unfit parents.
And that's the real...
love their children dearly, and they all take a great deal of care in training the children according to their Christian beliefs and educate the children and making sure that the children's medical needs are met. And they take a great deal of time. They exhibit a great deal of time and care concerning their children.
And so, in I think it's the fourth section of your injunction, you mention that there's a connection here, and you wanted to talk about it, regarding Tony Alamo's statements of opinions and the disbanding of this ministry and the taking of these children. And you state that in your brief that the defendants use statements made by Tony Alamo as proof of the risk of harm to all children in the church, and Americans can hold any set of beliefs, no matter how controversial. What they can't do is break the law. Now, for example, there's a whole class of people, you say, that support the legalization of marijuana and take measures to try to change the law. As long as they aren't distributing or using the drug, this belief cannot be held against them.
Right.
Now, the First Amendment, you state, protects against the prosecution of thought crimes. And you present cases that show that. Similarly, the holding of a thought or belief cannot be used as the basis of removing children. Another act of furtherance of the belief is required. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
Well, it's pure speech. And you can't prohibit, with some exceptions, it's not an absolute right, but you can't prohibit pure speech. We prosecute pornography because that's an exception to pure speech and that sort of thing. But you can't go after people by using the enormous police power of the state because they might be voicing opinions that are controversial.
Right. And we will
disagree with.
Exactly. And, I've known Tony and his ministry for years. His opinions are controversial in the mainstream America, who I believe really don't understand the truth about what's happening to their country. Tony, I believe, has talked about certain things that have upset the apple cart, and we know what that is. The listeners of my show know what that is. And for that, I've seen him be harassed for over 20 years. We've had federal agents come on this show talking about how this ministry was attacked in the 90s in the same manner, how people were hired to bring this man down, how it happened in the 80s, and now again in the 90s. Now, Tony's case is separate and apart from the case of the children, and we won't get into that today because there's another attorney representing him.
Right.
But Attorney Davis has mentioned publicly that he has a hard time getting people to come forward and testify for Tony for fear that the government is going to take retribution against them. Now, I believe that the same thing is perhaps going on in your case, and I'd make a plea to people out there, please tell the truth about what's going on here, because it can affect your family and your life in this country. And I believe this case is very important, don't you think, Mr. Kuhn, that gets to the heart of all of our rights?
I think it is, because I don't know, I don't know if it's a evidence of a trend or if it's just a pattern that the government has decided that they would use to go after people that they disagree with. But I do believe, and I can tell you from experience, that there is a lot of underlying currents going on that we really don't know anything about yet.
Right.
But
and that's why this case is important, and I really applaud you for taking it. Now, the key, one of the, in your third paragraph in this fourth section, you mentioned that Tony, and people know this because he's been on my show before, and some of his biblical views are disagreed upon by other Bible believers. However, I've tried to make the point that his views should not be held together with the taking of these children. And you say, well, Tony Alamo may or may not hold a belief that girls should marry after puberty. His beliefs are constitutionally protected and irrelevant in this case. The defendants make some unproven allegation that Alamo may practice his beliefs illegally. However, they fail to make any allegation that your clients, neither Krantz nor Ciego or others, have married an underage girl, nor that they plan to allow the marriage of their daughters before they are of age. And to the contrary, your clients have forbidden the marriage of his daughter at age 14 when she sought his permission to marry. And the Krantz daughters, others, these other daughters, don't even fall into this target age. So why are they taking these children is the question. And why is there a manhunt for another 100 children around the country?
Right.
It's, to me, an attack on the church.
Well,
your
thoughts? That's what we think. You know, just if that's the defendant's theory, that Tony's beliefs are somehow infecting the church in some manner that's detrimental to the children, and that underage marriages are going on, even, you know, that's hard. It's hard to justify taking a nursing baby from a mother on that basis, because there ain't no statement that says that children under the age of puberty are eligible for marriage. So why are they taking every child of the ministry?
Yeah. And why is there a manhunt for other children? Why are they harassing people in the ministry right now for passing out literature? I've got some interesting statements by the state prosecutor, which I mentioned yesterday on my show, which we won't get into today. But it appears to me that there's an underlying reason here, and they're using these children as a wedge to break up this ministry. My question to you is, if you, with this preliminary injunction, would this, in a sense, stop any further harassment of the church as far as what they do regarding the passing out of literature? Would it have an effect in that manner as well?
No, I think that the preliminary injunction would stop the state from looking for other children, parents of the church. And it would prevent them from taking newborns of members of the church. And hopefully it would eliminate the requirement that now
Mr. Kuhn, can you hold that thought? We're going to take a break for 3 minutes. Come back with us for a little while after the break. I got a few more questions. Back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
I was crying, lost in a lost world. So many people are dying, lost in a lost world.
Fight the fight. We are here to equip you. Because you love the truth, LibertyRadioLive.com. Don't buy the sizzle of that steak until you understand the cost. In other words, don't buy the hype being dispensed by the rare coin pitchman of the alternative media until you understand the full story. FlyingEagleGold.com. offers the most private, non-confiscable gold and silver coinage in the world. At very competitive cost, Jeffrey Bennett has been a purveyor of wealth protection, gold and silver bullion, and rare collectible coins for over 17 years. His personal experience reaches back to 1958, and he takes personal pride in putting your interests ahead of all else. To hear the whole story, not the hard sell, you're invited to call Flying Eagle Gold at 623-327-1778. That's 623-327-1778 for the truth about protecting your wealth. Join Jeffrey Bennett each day, Monday through Friday, when he hosts right here on LibertyRadioLive.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States in 1963.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no secret is revealed. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President today.
You were both in Skull and Bones, the secret society.
It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America?
It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America?
I've got a vision for what I want to do for the country. See, I know exactly where I want to lead. It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America?
Okay, we are back for the second half hour. My guest is Philip Kuhn. He's the attorney representing the Alamo Ministry. He has over 40 years of experience in civil rights cases, and he believes that this case is very important to protect your rights in the Constitution, which are absolutely protected, and that is your free that's in the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause of the Constitution that every law school in the country teaches. And it saddens me when I look back when I studied that, to see how it is abused by people who actually pass the bar and work in these state organizations who really somehow forget about this and collect a paycheck for it. When we listen to President Kennedy speak, and before I get back to Philip, let me just mention this. I believe what he's talking about is basically the people behind what's going on in the Alamo case and many other things in this country. We won't get into that today. But it reminds me. I better clear this up because I get these emails. Greg, Bush isn't the president anymore. Why do I do that? I do it for two reasons. I say he never legally was a president anyway because he has an oath that that superseded his oath, the oath he took when he was in Skull and Bones, which supersedes the oath of presidency. And then a second point is it really doesn't matter if it's Obama, Bush, or whoever. Because I believe since Kennedy, there hasn't been one president that has not been appointed. And when you look at the Hegelian dialectic, the left and the right in this country mean nothing anymore, and they control both sides. So what do I say? The best vote is a no vote. Don't even go to the polls anymore. That's my view. It's not the views of anybody else, the radio station, or my guest. And I just wanted to clear that up. Back to Philip Kuhn. Mr. Kuhn, this case, to me, represents a and I first want to applaud you for taking it, because there aren't many attorneys in this country anymore that would. And it protects, it is a case that is, if adjudicated properly, will show that the American people still have some rights in this country. And I wish you the best. But tell us the over, how you feel as a person. You went to law school years ago. I know exactly the cases you studied, because I studied the same. And it makes me feel sick that something even like this would happen in our country. And away from the case, what's your feelings regarding really some of the things going on in America right now?
Well, you know, when you're admitted to the bar, you take an oath. And part of the oath is the same oath that a judge takes, and it's the same oath that a Supreme Court justice takes. You take an oath before God that you will protect and preserve the Constitution of the United States. The Bill of Rights and the first 10 amendments are part of the Constitution. I know that some in authority don't believe that, but it's true. And the First Amendment plus one individual represents a majority in this country. There are some areas of life that people have a right to be let alone from governmental interference of any sort. And there are some elements of life that are purely individual, and the people have a right to make up their own decisions. And I haven't become jaded or bitter, even though I've been involved with the plaintiffs and civil rights for 40 years, because I believe what Disraeli said, the Prime Minister of England. He said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You can't have a democracy unless you have the critical analysis of government action at every stage and at every minute of their proceedings, that an uncritical acceptance of any governmental decision is the very foundation of tyranny. So I believe absolutely in the Bill of Rights. I think the Bill of Rights is a gift from God to this nation. And I took an oath before God years ago to protect and preserve those Bill of Rights. And I try to do that to the best of my ability.
And regarding this case, and getting back to it now, you, at the beginning of the show, I mentioned about 5 points that you brought up, which are quite important. And each one of them talks about how the state, when you say, when you just stated that there are certain things that individuals have a right to participate in without state interference, I think when you read these 5 points you make, and you can go over them with our listeners, you'll see that the state here has overstepped their bounds, not by just one little tiny step, but have taken a gigantic leap into the privacy of Americans, into the privacy of all of us, and our right to accept the fact that we have a right to worship our Creator, and in this Constitution, that means an absolute right, no matter what, even if it's in disagreement with what others believe in. So go over these points and show us how this government has really taken a giant step at stamping out the liberties of Americans. Go ahead.
Well, the Supreme Court has defined our right to our companionship and custody and control of our children and family integrity is a fundamental liberty interest. A fundamental liberty interest is that basic core value upon which democracy cannot survive or function unless that value is upheld. And it's part of what we call substance due process, meaning that the state can only interfere in that relationship upon very narrow stated grounds. And other than that, then that fundamental liberty interest gives the individual the ultimate superior prioritized right over the majority, over government action, over official authority of any kind. And I tell you, the three elements that we're probably most concerned about in this case is, first, the order of the state court judge that told the state of Arkansas to pick up and take into custody over 100 children that had not had the benefit of a hearing simply because of the parents' association with the church. I have never seen an order in 44 years. I have never seen an order like that in a civil rights case. I have never seen a state judge decide that over 100 children were in some sort of jeopardy without first giving them the right to some sort of hearing, because these children and these parents that they're looking for now were not part of the original Dependency Act. They've never had a hearing in court. The second thing I think that is really alarming is the threats by the defendants of taking newborns at the moment of birth. Like I said, I don't know how in the world you'd ever have evidence that a newborn was in any sort of danger of sexual abuse or sexual exploitation or neglect, absent the fact that the parents could be on drugs and that sort of thing, which that's legitimate. But there's absolutely no proof in this case that exists. And the third evil in the case is them requiring them to sever ties with the church in order to regain the custody of their children, which is forcing the parents choose between the free exercise of their religion or the custody of their children. And it really doesn't make any sense, because if the parents wanted to leave housing and employment, get secular employment, and still remain a member of the church, if the alleged wrongdoings were going on, that doesn't necessarily protect the children. I just think it's a deliberate attempt to disband this church and to harm this church in some manner. And it has harmed the church, because people have left because they didn't want to expose their children to the jeopardy of a foster care system. So those three elements, I don't see are any way connected to what the state has to prove that a juvenile is dependent and neglected.
Yeah, and there's a point here that should be talked about, too, in your brief. You mentioned, is it permissible for the defendants to vaccinate children in foster care over the religious objections of the church parents? And further, there's no law in Arkansas which makes vaccinations mandatory. This is basically an assault battery upon children.
Right. Arkansas has a statute that allows for religious objection.
Exactly.
To
me, that's just an outright assault and battery by the state. Don't you agree?
I agree with that.
Put a needle in somebody's arm.
Clearly outside the law.
Exactly. And in the conclusion here, you mentioned the things you're talking about here. You put it quite succinctly, and you state that the plaintiffs and your clients are now faced with the untenable choice between their children or the church. Such a draconian, schizophrenic alternative could never be accepted by the rational minds of men. In this country, the frail spirit of man could never survive such an assault by the lawfully constituted authorities. And so you're asking that they restore their God-given individual liberties and meet the full measure of their spiritual journey in the manner that they see fit, just as you and I or anyone else in this country who wakes up and goes into their church on Sunday has a right to do. It'd be similar to, there's a small church in the town I live in that may have a couple hundred people. It'd be similar for the state to walk in there and just say, look, you can't go into this church on Sunday and we're taking your kids. I don't see any difference, do you?
No. And just assume that Islam becomes a paramount religion in the United States, and they gain all political control, and they decide that being Christian is detrimental to a child's health.
Mm-hmm.
Think that they go in any church, you know. As far as I'm concerned, you know, the churches ought to wake up, because this assault is not only assault upon Tony Alamo Christian Ministry, it could be an assault on First Baptist Church of Dallas.
One of the sad things here is that I have not seen much support in the Christian community for this church, and save a few churches that have come to their assistance, a majority of the so-called, now put it in quotes, Christian evangelical ministers seem to be turning their nose at this, their nose up on this case, forgetting about it, and I wonder why. So you bring up a good point. Is there more behind the scenes here? I think your case now can open the door for a lot of things going on that the American people have no idea about.
Right.
And I applaud you for taking it. But have you seen the same? I don't see much support in this case, do you?
No, I don't see any kind of moral outrage at what happened, you know, what's happening to my client. And that's a sad thing, because, you know, the old saying in the Second World War, where the mayor of Warsaw said, they came for people I know, and I said nothing, and they came for my friends, and I said nothing. They came for my family, and I said nothing. And when they came for me, there was no one to say anything to.
And yes.
And you know, our rights as individuals that are embraced by the Bill of Rights are some very, very precious rights. And to assume that America is such a country that we could not have the establishment of Nazi Germany because somehow our character is above that is a dangerous assumption. Unless, you know, that. The old saying, you know, all that evil needs to accomplish its purpose is for good men to say nothing, is true when there are alleged violations of somebody's individual rights. You know, the rights of the worst of us are preserved only, the rights of the best of us are protected only as the rights of the worst of us are preserved. That
exactly.
The Bill of
well,
Rights is neutral and should apply to everyone. And I tell you, if there's a possibility that the state of Arkansas might take a newborn at the moment of birth without that mother ever holding that infant. And if that happens, there ought to be a moral outrage in the Texarkana community.
Exactly. And from what I hear, not many people in Texarkana are helping the Alamo ministry, including the churches there. In fact, if you look at some of the police actions, a sergeant in their police force in Texarkana has publicly stated on the radio and in a newspaper that if you see anybody passing out any Tony Alamo Christian ministry literature, please call us and we'll have them arrested.
Right.
Now,
that's not necessarily part of the injunction case.
Exactly.
But I think they've been subject to that in the past.
All right. My question was, well, why don't they say the same thing about the Jehovah Witness that comes to your door? Or why don't they say the same thing about the the Catholic who passes out information regarding the next bingo game that
right.
they're going to have at their church. And what else? I mean, we can go on and on. Is it just a singling out of this church? I think it is. And I think there's evidence to state to show that. Now, your case, let's just talk a little bit about a timeline here. How in your 40 years of practice, how do you see this thing playing out as far as time? I mean, is this going to
well,
be acted
right
upon quickly?
Yeah, right now we've got a jurisdictional issue because there's a jurisdiction. I don't want to say problem, but there's a question of jurisdiction. There's a doctrine in federal court that says basically a federal court can't interfere or mess around with state court proceedings unless you can show that state court proceedings were used to encroach upon First Amendment rights, and if you can show that the state acted in bad faith or they used state action pretextually for another purpose and that sort of thing. So the court's got to decide that jurisdiction issue.
Right, and that is what you talk about in the beginning of the Younger Doctrine, I believe it is?
Right. That was a Supreme Court case that was established in 1972, because in the 60s, the state used to require all kind of permits and restrictions on public displays.
Right.
And so the federal court was used to enjoin the state doing that on the basis of encroachment upon First Amendment freedom. So the Supreme Court in 1972, in a case called Younger, and I don't remember the name of the defendant, but it's the Younger Doctrine that basically established this abstention doctrine. And we knew that could be a problem. The client was advised of that before we even started this, because the state court proceedings had gone on for so long before we got in the case. But I still think we can overcome the doctrine, because I think that the dependency statutes of the state of Arkansas are being used pretextually by the defendant and for an improper purpose and are done in bad faith.
Exactly. So you're trying to show that they're using the state agency to basically disband the ministry, and this affects substantially their freedom of religion rights, correct?
Right. You know, it's very simple. If the state stands at a church door and says, if you join this church, I'm taking your children, I do not know why that wouldn't have a very chilling effect if somebody that wanted to join the church.
And that's exactly what they're doing.
That's exactly what they're doing. They're told, you know, by their orders, they've told everybody that anybody that has a child under the age of 18 that joins this church, you can expect that we'll file dependency actions and that we'll place your child in foster care.
Exactly. Now, switching gears here a bit, I hope this case... I hope your talk today, and this program will be sent all over the place, and I hope it inspires other talk show hosts to pick up on this story. Many have ignored it, even in the alternative media community. And I hope it wakes up people to see a bigger problem behind the scenes that's going on in this country all over. And we've documented on this show how the Department of Human and Family Services in states have been using children for monetary gains. In a sense, the federal government has passed laws which give financial interests to states, meaning Fed money, depending on the number of children that are in their program. So what we've seen is a huge abuse going on, huge abuse cases going on all over the country, where kids are taken, no matter if there's abuse or not, just so these agencies can keep, just so these people can keep their jobs and the federal money keeps flowing. It's a serious, serious problem. This case hopefully can open the door to that, because they have used Department of Children and Family Services in Arkansas to basically kidnap these children. And it goes on in other states. Florida, your state, Philip, I tell you, I've had people on regarding Department of Services there, and it's atrocious what's happened there. I know a man now hasn't seen his children for 4 years, just once a month. And basically, he did not, his family did absolutely nothing. It was a simple dog bite. And furthermore, there's a warrant out for his wife's arrest, and she's in hiding because they wanted to take the newborn baby they had a year after the case took place. It's insane.
There's just been a report issued yesterday that substantiated that over a period of 3 or 4 years, the Department of Children and Family Services here have administered psychiatric drugs to people, to children in foster care without medical supervision.
Sounds similar to Nazi Germany, doesn't it, Philip?
Unless we pay attention, this country is not immune from what has happened in other countries.
Okay, we're running out of time. We have a minute left. I don't want to cut you off in midstream, so I want to say thank you for coming on the show. We'll keep in touch with you as the case progresses, and I want to extend a big thanks to you for taking this case. And I know this for a fact. Many attorneys no longer will take this case because they do not want to butt heads with the federal government anymore. It's a sorry, sorry, sorry state of affairs. So thank you so much for taking it, using all your experience to help these people. And we will talk again.
I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, that was Philip Kuhn. We're just about out of time. We got a minute left, and I did want to use this minute to, again, emphasize the fact that Mr. Kuhn has an enormous amount of experience and has taken on this case and has presented a brief that should bring these kids home. If the judges look at this case from the standpoint that the First Amendment rights are being violated by the use of a state agency, the kidnapping of children, and just the horrors that can go on when you see how the Constitution can be abused by state agencies who usurp our God-given rights to assemble, to worship as we please, something that is protected absolutely by the Freedom of Religion clauses, the Establishment Clause, the Free Exercise Clause. And I might add, there's no compelling government interest here to keep these children. In fact, the abuse is run so deep that after these children are released, I would love to see some civil lawsuit filed for all the abuses these people have taken, and these people pay for what they've done. Thank you for listening to the show today. We're all out of time. We spent the whole week, really, on the Alamo case, and I hope it's enlightening. We pass this on. See you Monday. Good morning.